From Cheyenne to Cody, from Gillette to Rock Springs, this is Let's Talk Wyoming, your weekly double dose of Wyoming politics. Because politics may be complicated, but we're here to break it down and help you make sense of it all. I'm Amy Edmonds, a former legislator from Cheyenne. Thanks for being here. Welcome back to Let's Talk Wyoming. Well, we are in the second week of the Wyoming legislature. There's been a lot of things going on. The House and Senate have been very, very busy. We have a couple of things to talk about, but today, because if you're out on social media or you're paying attention a little bit to what's happening in the legislature, you might have noticed some issues around education, particularly on the House side, but those issues will continue as bills work their way over to the Senate. So I thought today we would spend some time talking about education. What the House worked on that has caused such a big ruckus and brouhaha is House Bill 199, Wyoming Freedom Scholarship Act. For those of you who might be aware from last year, this is basically the same bill that we saw in an education savings account bill that was amended last year and changed. It had some components for pre-K in it. The governor vetoed some things in that. The program is, however, went forward because the bill itself continued on. He only vetoed certain portions inside the bill. The bill went forward. The program began. It has only been going since the 1st of January. So this bill seeks to try to bring back some things that were taken out by the governor, but also bring back things that were amended out just through the normal process of debate, amendments, that sort of thing. The one thing that is not back in there at all is the pre-K portion. So I know that on the floor of the debate, someone discussed in debate, I think something like 26 families had applied for the pre-K portion of this. If this bill continues through without the pre-K in it, those families who applied will not be getting that because if the bill passes, it will strip out that pre-K portion. So for those of you who don't know, school choice is something that I care an awful lot about. It's a conservative principle and one that I share, this idea and understanding that, first of all, parents are the number one decision makers in their children's educational experience. And while, of course, some people like to bring up exceptions about parents, and there are no doubt that not everyone is cut out to be a good parent, and some people obviously lose their right to be a parent through actions of their own, that is the exception. That is not the rule. The rule in general is that most people are good parents and that they have every right to direct the education of their children. And so in school choice, the idea is that parents should have the right to and the ability to choose how they want to direct their children's education, and this idea of how that funding works, if the public education system should completely monopolize all of those public dollars, or if there are going to be decisions to open this up to the market and allow people to attend private schools or attend public charter schools that have a lot more flexibility in chartering how that education is going to be distributed to children. Homeschooling, obviously, co-op schooling. I mean, there's all kinds of ways in which kids get education. And this bill, I think, has really brought up a lot of discussions because the bill is really a universal education savings account. It's a very, very big, broad education savings account. And I have mixed feelings about this because, first of all, because I want school choice to succeed. And I do think that having careful, measured approaches to these things is always a good thing. This bill, I think, gives me pause because it also essentially takes away, and until essentially third reading, there was a rebuff of any amendments to try to put in some kind of accountability, whether it was through a testing mechanism or something, basically to just measure and qualify the amount of learning that children might be getting, as well as any kind of accountability in terms of verifying where the dollars are actually going and how they're being spent. And what, and those were pretty much rebuffed. There was one amendment put on at third reading that allowed for a small measure of testing, which I think was very good. That was a huge improvement to the bill. But I just want to talk for a second about my feelings in terms of school choice and why it's important, but more importantly, why this bill gives me pause. Because number one, and I have to qualify this as a conservative, but also as a Christian woman, there's nothing special about people who seek alternative ways to educate their children. There's nothing special about people who choose school choice and want that option, right? And all people inherently can do bad things. And which is one of the reasons why, even in public education with public dollars, we want some sense of accountability. Are you educating these children? Are they properly getting education? And certainly, libertarians might counter with, well, the market will work that out, right? If your child is not being educated properly, you'll move to a different school. Well, certainly that's the case in choice, but this is a universal choice bill, which means you could simply be you could be schooling your child at home, or you could be choosing some online program in which there's really no sense of accountability. And I think that is such an important part of this, because there's just nothing inherently special about people who choose choice or who choose public education. I mean, conversely, I'd say the same thing about public education seekers. There's nothing special. Everyone should be held accountable. People are capable of doing bad things. There's people are capable of committing fraud in systems like this. People are capable of using the system in bad ways. It's why we put up these kinds of measures to hold people accountable. Show the receipts. I mean, that's essentially, I think that's something we could all understand. Like, show the receipts, show how you're educating your kid. And if you don't want to show receipts, don't take public money. I mean, that's pretty simple. If you don't want to show receipts, then don't take public money. But this is public money. This is an education, you know, scholarship or an education savings account, what used to be called in the day vouchers. So if you're going to take public money, like all the public money that's being spent, you know, we all expect some form of accountability. We have this same expectation in just about every form of public money that's out there, from how your cities and towns spend funds. We want transparency. We demand to know, how is this money being spent? Why? Because, well, it's all of our money. It all comes through the system of taxation that we've all agreed to. And so when we set up one sector, whether, you know, in this case, it's people who choose who want some alternative kind of education, when we set them up to all be angels, when we set them up to be somehow inherently different from everybody else, it's a recipe for failure. I mean, I might sound jaded, but that's a recipe for failure, because people are all the same inherently. And I know I probably sound like someone who's very jaded, but I do believe in total depravity, since I am a Christian, and I do believe that people can be inherently bad. And that's why accountability, checks and balances, show me the receipts, are important. And I don't think it's any kind of heavy burden to ask that and expect that in public dollars, unless you truly, you know, truly are, I think, someone who wants, you know, the government out of everything. And in which case, you shouldn't be seeking this anyway, because these are public dollars. So this is the bill that's caused a tremendous amount of brouhaha. The bill has passed through the House. As I said, in third reading, they did allow for one amendment to be put on to have a small amount of, I should not say small, excuse me, to have testing included, or some kind of assessment included. I think there's a lot of other things that probably could strengthen this bill. I think we'll see the Senate. I mean, as I said last week, and I'll keep saying week after week, the Senate is going to have to do a lot of work on a lot of these things. They'll be, I think, a lot more deliberative and be more willing to have these conversations. The House, because it's controlled by the Freedom Caucus, and because, you know, they're kind of gimmicky over there, and they want to sell these things out to the public in kind of marketing campaigns. They really don't want to make any changes. They want to be able to just keep things as they are and say, look, we won. So I think we'll see some changes in the Senate, but it has certainly caused a lot of brouhaha, as has House Bill 100. It's another education bill. It's a bill to essentially say that teaching certifications are not required for anyone that school districts might hire to be teachers. For obvious reasons, that's a very strange thing. Wyoming does have, so when I served, I wanted to and brought an alternative teacher certification bill. It didn't go anywhere. But since I've been in the legislature until now, the state has indeed changed. And there's four or five different tracks to have alternative teacher certification. And what that means, what I like about alternative teacher certifications, what I like about them, not House Bill 100. I'm not a fan of House Bill 100, but what I like about them is that, you know, there's a lot of folks who retire, maybe even retire early. You might have somebody who has a PhD or a master's or a higher degree in, say, Russian. And maybe your local school needs a Russian teacher. There's no reason for someone with an advanced degree to have to go back to a teaching college and get 4 years. There should be, and there are all kinds of ways that they can get a certification to teach in a classroom. And I don't say this to demean the work that it takes to become a teacher. And certainly not everybody can just bumble in off the street, even with an advanced degree, and think that they're going to teach well. I think, you know, certainly folks get these alternative certificates and in the process of, you know, being in a program for 4 or 5 months or however long it takes to get them, they realize maybe this isn't my cup of tea, but in general, it works really well. And it should work well, and it helps in places where getting teachers is becoming more difficult. But this bill seeks to take all of that away. You don't need an advanced degree. You don't need a 4-year degree. You don't need any degree. You need to be 18 years old and be able to pass a background check. That's not enough to be able to teach in a classroom. And I think that's also, listen, I think that's also deeply insulting to teachers who are professionals and who have gone through college to get a degree and who continue, just like any other profession, continue to have, you know, continuing education to learn and to grow in their profession. So that bill is out there. I don't believe it's even been heard in education yet, but it is sponsored by the chair of education, Representative Ocean Andrews, who also brought the House Bill 199, the Wyoming Freedom Scholarship Act, and also stood and rebuffed any amendments to it. And so we'll see where that goes. Representative Andrew might, I mean, obviously, if he's the chairman of the committee, he has a great chance of getting this bill through, certainly on the House side. So again, this is where the Senate might come into play. And where the Senate will most likely take a bill like House Bill 100 and put it in a drawer and not see it again. So some of the other doings in the legislature, now that we've covered education, I think fairly well in terms of choice. Although, let me just go back one more time for choice. There's a lot of discussion about the charter school system in Wyoming. We see more charter schools being opened. There's obviously a cap on charter schools right now. I'm not a fan of caps because I believe the system can work. However, the only way that Wyoming is going to have excellence in charter schools is to have excellence in charter school authorizers. The problem when I was in the legislature and the problem we tried to fix and couldn't, because most of us conservatives were rebuffed and told no every time, again and again and again. But what we need are excellence in charter authorizers. Your local school district school board is not excellence in charter authorizers. As a matter of fact, they're competitors. And so that was the problem when I was in. That's why we had no charter schools, because of course the school board just said no, or even back then didn't even bother to accept the application or do anything with an application. They were not compelled in any way by the state statutes to have to do something. So one of the first things we did was to put into the statutes at least a timeline that says when you get an application, you have this long, then you have to have a hearing, then you have to listen, then you have to decide. But it was still asking Walmart to decide whether or not, you know, it wanted a Kmart next to it, right? And Walmart surprisingly always said no. Or unsurprisingly always said no. But what we have, or what we need to have, and what we should have, and we've had, is, or at least we're beginning to have, is an excellent charter school authorizer. And what that means is some kind of board. They're done in all kinds of ways. Governors appoint them. In cities, sometimes it's the mayor who appoints them. But it needs to be serious people who understand the business of running schools. Because again, as I say about even people who want or seek out choice, there's nothing inherently special. But starting a school and running a school does require skills. It requires a business plan. It requires understanding the day-to-day operations in a school, not just the education, but what it takes to open the doors, have children, have them safely in an environment, learning in heat, you know, heat in the winter, cool in the summer, all the stuff, right? And also what it takes to put together an excellent curriculum and keep, and that will educate kids. That starts with your authorizer. That's the most important thing you can do is have an excellent authorizer. And as you build capacity in having an authorizer and folks who are learning what good schools look like, and also what good schools, not just the curriculum, not just the day to day, but also the financial aspects, how they use their money. Because charter schools are obviously public schools, so they're taking public dollars. What kind of audit system, all the things to ensure that those funds are used appropriately, they're not embezzled or scammed or something nefarious is happening, starts with the authorizer. And Wyoming has a cap right now. I'm not a fan of the cap, but what I would say is if we're going to get rid of the cap, we need to make sure that we have excellence in authorizers and that we have that strong accountability. And I say all these things not because somehow, because, you know, oftentimes people are accused, well, you must not like things because you want these extra steps. No, I'm a strong supporter of school choice. But if you take a page in history, school choice can become very curdled, can become very sour or rotten in communities and in states where fraud is found at high levels. People can very quickly decide this is not good. And so I don't want that to happen in Wyoming. I want these schools to be performing at an excellent level. And that takes a measured approach. And we're in a big rush, it feels like, particularly with bills like House Bill 199. We're in a really big rush to try to shove these things through and think that, you know, that's going to achieve something. I think a lot of it will. I'm not necessarily against 199 with some guardrails on it, but I do think that, you know, taking the time, the one thing we know in Wyoming is we just don't have the capacity in terms of schools. Now, under the old saying, if you build it, they will come, certainly having a Freedom Scholarship Act will bring more people into the state. Whether those are people who are here to truly achieve excellence in education, or if they're just here to make a buck, is the worrisome part of this. Because there are lots of education and, you know, education delivery vendors online and in other ways who may not be actually there to achieve excellence. And so, and in my mind, I mean, this is the separation. For me, the reason that I've always supported school choice is that, number one, the idea that parents have the right to choose. And we have too many children sitting in failing schools all over the country. And even here in Wyoming, we have schools to this day that are failing in the middle of the state consistently year upon year. And that is a missed opportunity that can never be gotten back for those children. And so parents should have choice and should have the right to say, this school is failing. I want to put my child somewhere else. I can't. I want that public dollar to follow me to somewhere else. Because otherwise I am trapped. If the dollar itself can't move with my child to educate my child, then I'm trapped. And in a country like ours, the greatest country on the planet, this is not that hard to do. The public dollar should be able to follow the child, because the public dollar is not there to support a failing system. It's not there to support failing teachers. It's not there to support a failing school. It's there to educate a child. That's what we as a country decided those so many years ago. And it's a worthy and noble endeavor to which we are all still completely and wholeheartedly in support of, or at least most of us, including myself. But I support the idea of educating children, not refreshing failing systems year upon year upon year upon year. And so those dollars should follow the child, not necessarily the system. Now, I say that as someone who is very much in support of our rural schools and how important rural schools are to communities. I grew up in a rural school, a town of 400. When my school was consolidated in Nebraska, it forever changed my small town. It basically ruined it. I mean, it is not. Schools are the heart blood. But so many of our rural schools are really not the problem. They are providing excellence in education. They're providing a fairly good education for the kids across the state. So, and just one last point on education This is going to be a short one this week, guys, because I've got a whole bunch of other things happening. But education, public education, and the idea of school choice should not be one or the other. And it should never be couched that way. It's not that you either support public schools and public teachers, or you support school, or you support school choice. It's a both in my mind. It's always been a both in my mind. I don't support school choice because somehow I think it's going to hurt or harm public schools, and by golly, I want to cause them harm. I was educated in the public school system in a small town. And I had a great education and loved it. And I think our education system, our public education system, is excellent, including our public charter schools. So it should not be a fight one to the other. And while I know that it becomes a fight because people are scrambling for what they see as the same dollars, I think you have to think of it differently. I think you have to look at it differently. Those dollars, again, are not there to refresh a system. Those dollars are there to educate a child. However those parents decide that child should be educated, that's what the dollars are there to do. Okay, so one other thing I think we'll talk about right after this break is a hand counting bill over in the House. I just want to bring that up very quickly, and then some property tax stuff in the Senate. So hold for the break, guys. All right, so before we wrap up for this week, I wanted to talk a little bit about, there was a slew of more election integrity pieces of legislation on the House side. We had House Bill 232, which was hand counting for recounts. And then we had House Bill 307, poll watchers, which went to House Education. Not a normal committee for a bill like that, but it went there. I think there's a lot to be said about ensuring the integrity of elections. I think there's also a lot to be said about what happens when we allow people who have suspicions, unsubstantiated suspicions, be able to sort of lead the discussion, right? And so we had an example of that on House Bill 307, poll watchers. This bill was brought by Representative Pendergraf, and inside the discussion of the bill, he made reference to some essentially hinky things that he said had been happening, or he had heard had been happening. And he, in this moment, he referenced Park County. And then he was asked by Representative J.D. Williams to elaborate on what he meant by that. And then he just laid the claim out. And I'm going to play the clip for you so you can actually hear his words. You can hear the question being asked by Representative Williams, and you can hear his response. But in his response, he lays out what essentially, folks, under Wyoming law would be a felony offense. So under Wyoming law, any elected official who violates Title 22, including the premature destruction of a ballot before the time period for ballots that are supposed to be held, the clerks hold ballots for, you know, obvious reasons. If you maliciously destroyed them before that time frame is up, you are essentially violating the election code. That violation has its own penalty to it, but any violation of the code itself by an elected official is a felony offense. So he is describing in a public meeting, publicly, as a elected representative, his understanding or his knowledge of a felony offense. Let's go to the clip.
Further questions for the sponsor, Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Pendergraf. You referenced some situations in the past where things were not forthcoming. Could you elaborate on those just a little bit?
Representative Pendergraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Williams. There was one example where in Park County, some citizens were kind of questioning the results. And they asked to be able to do a hand count. And this is a slightly different issue than what I'm talking about. But I think this particular incident illustrates my point better than some of the others. So they went and just asked, and the votes had already been counted, and it was agreed that whatever they did was not going to change the election. It was already, had already been signed, sealed, and delivered. But they just wanted to confirm that things were done properly and in order, and that indeed the results that did come out were exactly what had happened. And there was a lot of foot dragging. There was a lot of back and forth as about whether or not you could actually see the ballots. Things went back and forth. So it went through the court system. There is a time limit on how long these ballots survive, and then at a certain prescribed time, the ballots are be destroyed. And the end of the story is, just about the time when these people had arranged to be able to actually go through and do a sample hand count to validate the results, they went to go pick up the ballots, and the ballots had been destroyed prematurely. If you got nothing to hide, you got nothing to hide, you know? In fact, if you put it out there and it verifies exactly what was there, then you quell all of these rumors and all of these questions, to me, it just makes sense to be as open and transparent as you possibly can. And any reluctance to do so causes more suspicion and more issues.
Okay, so any, you know, you should have nothing to hide, essentially, is what he's saying. And that anybody who has doubts and any hesitancy to do anything is somehow acknowledgement of a crime, which I think we all know is absolutely ridiculous. And given the amount of crazy conspiracies that we've been hearing about our elections for the past 4 years, I think it's safe to say that our clerks have been more than diligent in their work, and also have more than earned their keep in trying to navigate the political field when dealing with people who believe things that are simply not true. But I think what concerns me the most about this, and listen, this is now risen to the level of a formal complaint. A formal complaint was actually filed by someone in Park County to the legislature saying that they believe Representative Pendergraft should either produce facts to substantiate his claims, or he should apologize for essentially besmirching that clerk, and also, I mean, by absentia, all clerks. I think the other point that's concerning is that, you know, the Secretary of State, who had been in the room, I don't know if he was in the room at the time that this claim was made, but certainly there's been plenty of play. And this guy puts out a press release every 35 seconds for every possible kind of deal. But he's said nothing. He has said nothing. And we have plenty of headlines that he's already constantly at war with our county clerks, essentially. He has said and done nothing. This is, again, claim of a felony offense, which we should all take deadly seriously. And there is a duty to act, even as an elected official, if you are made aware of a felony offense. And yet the felony offense is just laid out casually in an education meeting to support some bill about poll watchers. So there's going to be more going on here, folks. I will keep you up to date in terms of what's happening with this complaint against Representative Pendergraft, and whether it takes legs, whether the Freedom Caucus takes this seriously and does something about it, or whether it's just swept under the rug. I'll give you an update next week. All right, folks, this is a short one. I have to apologize for being a day late. Life has gotten in the way. Weekly podcast is showing itself to be a big endeavor for someone who is only doing this as sort of a fun thing to do. That's not my real life job. But I'm so glad that you're listening, and I'm thrilled to be here talking about these issues in the legislature in Wyoming and politics in general. I'm going to leave you with something really fun. Okay. So a lot of lawmakers out there talking on social media about a bunch of stuff, but I want to flag somebody for you because I just love this guy. I love his videos. I love the way he talks about things. He is so authentically Wyoming in so many ways. Representative J.D. Williams. If you're not following him, go to social media, particularly Facebook, and type in J.D. Williams, Representative J.D. Williams. You will find him. Representative Williams did a video on our tax structure. Just an instructional video. It's one of the best I think I've ever heard. It is so smart. You're going to learn something when you listen to this. It's just a couple minutes long. So Representative Williams is going to take us out at the end of this podcast. So I'm going to let you listen to him. Have a great weekend, folks. I look forward to talking to you next week.
Hello, House District 2. Representative J.D. Williams here. All right, neighbors, let's talk a little bit about where the state of Wyoming gets its money and where it spends its money. It's not a real exciting topic, but it is important. Our state revenue is supplied primarily by sales and use taxes, by interest income from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, by severance taxes, and by federal mineral royalties and coal lease bonuses. So really, other than the fraction of sales and use taxes that we pay personally, the rest of the state's bills are shouldered by our mineral industries. That is why Wyoming has one of the lowest personal tax burdens in the nation. Only Alaskans pay less taxes than we do. We are one of only seven states that do not have an income tax. The largest expenditures of state money go to the health department, to K-12 education, to the Department of Family Services, to the Department of Environmental Quality, to the National Guard, to our community colleges, and to our university. About one out of every $5 the state spends are federal dollars. So with an annual budget of over $5 billion, just over $1 billion of those dollars are federal. But that's not the whole story, because there are federal funds that are sent directly to local governments that are not included in these numbers. In addition, most of the Wyoming Department of Transportation's funding for road construction is also federal money that is administered by the Transportation Commission instead of the legislature. The Wyoming Department of Transportation has an annual budget of almost $900 million, with a majority of those funds coming from federal sources, added to the fuel taxes and vehicle registration revenues that are collected here in the state. A little closer to home, our local governments are funded in part by the state through sales and use taxes, through federal mineral royalties, through severance taxes, fuel taxes, and lodging taxes. Local governments are also funded by grants and loans through the state, as well as direct distributions from legislative appropriations. The direct distribution formula considers county and municipal property taxes, sales and use taxes, and population. Revenue hardship counties and municipalities like ours in House District 2 benefit a little more from the direct distribution formula because of our lower assessed values and lower sales and use taxes. I will include a link that is helpful reference when you're considering these topics. Until next time, Wyoming, adios.